Hi, everybody. This is Joanne, Science Goddess on Twitter, and I am joined today by my co-host, Jeff Schomeyer, sitting over there near D.C., and our special guest today is Sarah Parkak. You want to say hi so you can be friends?
Hey, what's going on, everyone? Thanks for coming.
I am so excited to talk to Sarah because she has written a book, and this follows her TED Talks and her BBC shows and her work as a real live archaeologist. Is this book called Archaeology from Space, How the Future Shapes Our Past, and learned a large variety of things in here, told in a really nice, breezy way, biographical. So I learned a lot about you, Sarah. I guess you meant to do that.
I hope I did. It's too late now.
Okay, but for those of you who don't know Sarah, I'm going to read her bio. Sarah Parkak is a professor of anthropology at the University of Alabama at Birmingham, president and founder of Global Explorer, and co-director of the Joint LISHT Mission, Egypt. I hope I said that right. Her remote sensing work has been the focus of three BBC specials covering Egypt, ancient Rome, and the Vikings. She is a fellow in the Society of Antiquaries, a 2014 TED Senior Fellow, and a winner of the 2016 TED Prize and a National Geographic Explorer. And hopefully we will sort of touch on most of these things today. That's so cool. Welcome.
Thank you. Thank you for having me here.
Yeah, we're glad.
Not only did we learn a lot about about Sarah, but we learned a lot about archaeology and Egyptology and remote sensing and how these things all relate. There were so many good stories that I was almost confounded by where I thought I wanted to start talking. But there was a little story that you told early on that I thought really was important for some people who have only a vague idea of what archaeology is and what interests archaeologists.
Oh, sorry, I'm going to turn my phone.
Okay.
Okay.
My phone. Sorry, guys. 2 seconds.
Okay.
No problem. No. I think live recordings are cool.
Spam callers.
That's right.
And I didn't figure out how to solve them. I'm sorry, everyone.
And there were a couple times you reiterated the point of this story by talking about how archaeology is not about finding the next King Tut exhibit to travel. And I thought this was so valuable in finding out the depths and things. So here's a little story that you told that I want to talk about. In most post-apocalyptic movies, you see hordes of bad guys wearing leather, riding motorcycles, armed to the teeth, and living in bad guy strongholds. I, meaning you, Sarah, always wonder where their underlying support system is and ask about the thousands of people tanning their clothing, processing their fuel for their vehicles, and working in the fields to feed them. What does that have to do with interests in archaeology?
So clearly, I'm a total nerd. I love sci-fi, I love fantasy. I grew up on those types of books and still read them, and they largely informed a lot of what I wrote. And so when you think about archaeology, what we do has a lot to do with fantasy and science fiction, in that we are recreating lost worlds or worlds mm-hmm. that only exist in sort of a fragmentary sense today. So you may go to a museum and you're like, oh my gosh, that's the throne of King Tut, and it's beautiful and it has all these semi-precious jewels, and isn't it amazing? That's like one trillionth of a sliver of what that society existed at thousands of years ago. And it's not just about chair and the object, it's about the goldsmith. It's about the fact that the bureaucracy existed to send expeditions hundreds and sometimes over 1,000 miles away to obtain those raw materials. They had to mine for them and understand what they were and process them and then make these things. And then the court had to support artisans, and then of course you've got to feed them. So when you think about what you typically see in museums, most people are not archaeologists. They only see the archaeological world or record when they see these objects or see things on TV. It's hard to imagine this whole world behind what you're seeing. And so whenever I watch a post-apocalyptic movie, and there's certainly a lot, like all these things just appear out of thin air, you know, like, okay, I get it. Like bad guys, like playing the bass and there's fire coming out of like metal cars and that's awesome. But, you know, and I keep expecting the curtain to be pulled up and this like grand vista of villages and farms. And it's like, okay, we're gonna let the bad guys do their thing, but we're gonna like do the feeding and getting the water and whatnot. Like you can't think, people don't exist in vacuums. And objects don't exist in vacuums. So I guess that's why I told that story, trying to get people to think like, even today, even the way societies work, movies get it wrong. And we need to understand and kind of hold Hollywood accountable to telling the whole story. Cause I think that would be interesting. Like tell the story of like the people that are in charge of the cows, that they're using the tan, the leather to make the bad guy jackets.
Well, and you showed us some hints of that. I mean, the producer in Hollywood is going to say, how can I make that story interesting of the guy who's selling the gasoline or tanning the leather? But you talked about some excavations that you were doing. The stories that you were telling about were in Egypt, and you were talking about reconstructing sort of the life of an almost normal family, let's say a middle-class family in right. The support structure. Why is that interesting? How do you make that interesting for the producer?
So that, you know, one of the stories that I told is about this woman named Merit. And while she, you know, we don't know if that was this person's name, but the story is fictional, but based entirely in archaeological fact. But actually the story is based on a skeleton of a woman in her 40s or 50s that was excavated at the site in the Northeast Egyptian Delta called Tel Ibrahim Wad. And I told the story of what happened at the end of Egypt's Great Pyramid Age, so 4,200 years ago, internal strife, economic problems, social problems. Is this all sounding familiar? Yep. Climate change kind of all came together to cause the downfall of Egypt's Great Pyramid Age. So around 4,200 years ago, no more pyramids were built. There were no more foreign expeditions. The art gets really wonky. We know of a lot of internal strife. There are inscriptions that talk about this. So I wanted to tell the story of what happened at the end of this period of time through the eyes, of this woman and what happened to her as a young girl growing up, what she saw. Because to me, one of the biggest challenges we have in archaeology is when you're standing in a museum and you're looking at these objects, it's hard to feel connected to the people. You know, we see the objects, we don't see the people behind them. So by showing and recreating this world through the eyes of this anonymous woman, ancient Egyptian woman, and you're showing her struggles and her love and the pain she feels when she loses someone, and the full arc of her life, and kind of stepping back and talking about the archaeological record, I'm hoping that readers of the book will feel really empathetic and connected to the past in ways that they perhaps haven't done so before. And then by kind of lensing back and forth between her story and then going, okay, like telling you the story of the Old Kingdom through the eyes of this woman, but let me tell you about what the archaeological record shows, this balance. So it's really all about empathy. It's really all of it, because that's the heart of the best stories and the best movies and the best characters that you see. You feel so connected to them, and you're rooting for them or you're rooting against them, and it's because you're connected to them.
But part of the scientific discovery realism, the archaeology quest, the puzzle solving that really turns me on and I think motivates a lot of scientists was you didn't just make up this story. You recreated this story from deductions you were able to make from the smallest grain of sand, I think literally in one case. And those I think were some fascinating stories that filled this out, not just as sort of stories about the past, but as what actually lies the motivation for doing the archaeology and things. Some amazing deductions. Am I getting the right one, that there was the piece of sand that you saw in the eye of a painting related, wasn't it, to this woman's coffin?
And right. So So yeah, so that's a wild story. So in 2014, I got the chance to work with Homeland Security. Unless that sends off alarm bells, this is not immigration. This is customs. These are the folks that are in charge of checking to make sure that the things coming into the U.S. really are exactly what people say they are. And so this guy, Joe Lewis, who's a big collector, had sent these objects through the U.S. Postal Service, and these totally sketchy Jordanian dudes who are illegal antiquities dealers had shipped these objects to him. He threw his hands up and was like, I didn't know.
Yeah,
dude, these things were sawed in half and sent through the postal system. He totally knew. Anyway, so the objects were sitting in a warehouse run by customs in Brooklyn. So I got to go and see them in person about 4 years ago. And so I had all this data from my all the work we'd done analyzing satellite imagery of looted areas. And what the customs agent with whom I worked said is, look, we know these are Egyptian. Clearly they're Egyptian. They're real. We've had Egyptologists look at them, but we have no idea where they could come from. Mm-hmm. You know, you think your looting data could help in any way, because the biggest challenge that customs has in the U.S. when proving cases regarding looting is probable cause. Yeah. If they can say to the judge, like, this object is likely to have come from here, it is probable based on all this evidence, they can prosecute. So this gorgeous sarcophagus, beautiful colors, there's a picture of her in the book, one of the most beautiful sarcophagi I've ever seen. And in her eyes, you could actually see little flecks of sand, and that isn't something you typically see in a sarcophagi. They didn't ritually put sand in,
right,
in eyes. In other words, she came from a very sandy environment, ergo desert. And so I thought, well, wait a minute. She comes from a desert site, and she comes from the late period / Ptolemaic period. I wonder if I can take all my data and work backwards. So that's what I did. I sort of tested myself, and I'm like, I didn't know if it would work or not. It could, could have failed. But I had this database of all these looted sites, and I started from here. Then, okay, what sites are late period Ptolemaic? What sites are near the desert? Okay, look at her inscription information. What other names are on objects that come from potential areas? And pretty soon we'd narrowed it down to one site that's near the Fayum that's been pretty heavily looted. And so I think there's a pretty high degree of likelihood that she came from that site. So it's just imagining who she was, and it's this very powerful, rich woman, and this idea that her grave was desecrated. Again, it's like there's so many through lines of how we can connect to the past, and you just wonder why do people want to steal this stuff?
Mm-hmm. Well, that maybe we'll get to looting, but it's so sad. But I was very excited by that story as the for the science that was implicit in it, and how that works, and how it seems like magic to people in the same way that Sherlock Holmes' deduction seemed like magic to Watson. And then once he explains it, it's obvious. But it's a good thing to explain, because this is the thrill of science, of pulling that little thread and then following where it goes, and then building these quite rational deductions and learning amazing things about this person, all based on a bit of sand and your data from a remote sensing application. So we're going to have to start get into space and what in the world space has to do with things a little bit. But I don't know. Joanne is thinking of something, I can tell. Yeah.
Joanne is trying to figure out why it says people are waiting to watch this, but then I found there's a completely different link. So something in my confusion this morning made technical issues. Uh-oh. So we're talking. So keep talking while I sort this out. I think I've almost got it figured out.
Okay.
So, I'm so sorry.
Well, let's bring the satellites into it and establish what remote sensing is, what that could possibly have to do, how that leads us to, I don't know, finding everyday walls of houses and things like that. And the fact that really brought it home for me was where you calculate a possible number of how many sites there are that are unknown and undiscovered, and how absurdly impossible it would be for actual people to go through data to try to locate these things. But Anyway, what's remote sensing in this that we need to know about for this?
Just so something you alluded to right at the beginning, you know, the idea of remote sensing. You know, our eyes remotely sense the world around us. It's any kind of sensor system you use to see things. The field of remote sensing generally refers to the use of satellite imagery or drone-based platforms or aerial photography or helicopter imagery and taking pictures of the Earth's surface. And then processing that information using computer algorithms and standard off-the-shelf computer software to see anything that we simply might not be able to see with our naked eyes. So the great thing about satellite imagery, and pretty much everyone watching will, of course, have used Google Earth, you can see so much just visually. You see shapes and patterns and relationships, and you see things in places where you might not physically be able to go. So we always start off using Google Earth, using visual data, just to get a sense of a landscape. But the thing is, we can only see in a very, very narrow part of light spectrum. This extends to the near, middle, far infrared, thermal IR, microwave. And so Matt had explained to me once, if you were to stretch out the light spectrum around the globe, we humans would only have the ability to see a pencil wide width of it. Mm-hmm. That's bonkers, right? Like we're basically blind to the world around us. And every object, every type of thing on the surface of the earth, whether it's a plant or water or a type of soil, emits its own very distinct chemical signature across the light spectrum. So just like we have unique signatures, so does everything on the Earth's surface. And by interpreting these things in different parts of the light spectrum, we can pick out individual features. So biologists use this to look at specific types of vegetation in the rainforest, and all of them have their own distinct signatures. Geologists use this to detect different types of rock, which they can then go out and analyze. So what we archaeologists do is we look for specific chemical signatures of archaeological features that may either be on the surface or just below the ground. And whether it's a wall, whether it's a whole site, whether it's a pyramid or a temple, or whether it's beneath the rainforest, you can't use the same technique to find a buried pyramid in Egypt as you can to find a Maya city underneath the rainforest. So we're using different techniques, using different imagery sources, kind of going back to the CSI kind of detective theme, right? It's all a big mystery. Like, okay, we're looking for X, and how do we even start?
Well, make the connection between how we can see and how it comes about that we can see evidence of ancient walls that are buried.
So imagine use an example that a lot of people know. Imagine like a Roman villa buried underneath a field in Italy. You're walking over this field, and maybe it's like, I don't know, alfalfa for cow fodder. You can't see anything. Everything looks the same. You're like, there's not a villa here. But here's the thing. The alfalfa roots are growing into the ground, and then they're hitting the wall. They're hitting the wall that's maybe 5, 10, 20, 30 centimeters below the surface. And those roots can't go deep enough to get the water that they need. So those plants that are growing right on top of that wall are going to be slightly less healthy than the vegetation around them. We can't see that visually, but vegetation reflects most strongly in the infrared because chlorophyll, which is what plants contain, reflects most strongly in the infrared. So by looking at the data in the infrared, we see the strip of slightly less healthy vegetation that indicates a wall under the ground. But flip that around. So say you're dealing with like an Iron Age hill fort in Britain. Mm-hmm. Well, it's got a ditch system, and the ditch fills up with mulch and rotting vegetation and goodness knows what else. And so over time, it's going to continue to be moist. And so then you're going to have a slightly healthier strip of vegetation, because even when the air around it is super dry, that ditch system is going to be slightly more damp. And we saw this last summer, which was one of the driest summers in the history of Britain. And archaeologists were having a field day because hundreds and hundreds of features were showing up because of the dryness of soil.
And so when we talk about seeing these things from space, you have the advantage of being able to see someplace where you can't necessarily penetrate or get to easily. you have the advantage of being some distance away, which gives you a bit of a big picture effect that you can zoom in on, which is nice. But doing this hyperspectral sensing also allows you to see these contrasts and things. So if you look at the picture in the right wavelengths, you start to see actual these outlines, right? I mean, it's like they're there, and that's pretty startling. I won't say they jump out because you have to train your eyes some, but they're there, and you just can't see them by walking around.
It's a mix. Sometimes things are super clear. Sometimes it's a little more ambiguous, and you've got to play with like edge detection or try combining the bands or try majorly enhancing them. So there's a lot of fiddling. So you're applying all these different remote sensing algorithms and techniques and tests. And then you kind of may get the faint hint of a something. And then you're throwing the kitchen sink at it and trying to get it to really pop out. And this sometimes can give you false positives. I mean, this is science. Welcome to science.
Yes.
False positives, yes, all the time. But it's sort of like a slightly blurry space-based CAT scan or X-ray, where maybe you can't see everything, but certainly a lot is clear because you're using this technology.
This is the part in my house where we're watching a movie and we get to the critical moment where someone invariably, just after we yell it, says, enhance. And,
right.
But actually some things can happen that way and you can do things. And so you talk about all of the available imagery that's available already from satellites, and then you talk about the work and give us good insights on what you do to combine those, look at different spectra at the same time, different wavelengths, and then do some of these manipulations that help you enhance contrast and things like that, so that you can find these signatures that you now know what to look for. And that's another exciting adventure that was very, very nicely told. Thank you.
Thank you. Yeah, I mean, it being science, you can't ever just try, oh, it's the, it's the QuickBird satellite and it's this technique and it's this one thing. Like, why limit yourself when you have so many different kinds of satellites, so many different kinds of techniques, and of course, different techniques work differently on different satellite images, depending on, say, the range of the spectra that each individual satellite image band covers. And also the time of year matters greatly because weather patterns vary greatly. Some techniques work really, really well, like what I mentioned in England, because it's dry, versus other parts of the world where you want it to be slightly more damp, or it's really rainy in the rainforest, in Central America or Cambodia. Some techniques don't work well because everything's saturated versus a drier period of time. So yeah, there is a lot of detective work, and it's not just understanding the weather. You have to understand the local geology. What is the soil like? Is it sandy? Is it clay-like? Is it densely urbanized? Has it been plowed over time? How much anthropogenic change has that landscape seen aside from the archaeology? So you're never working in a vacuum. You're always trying to understand the full context and the science behind what has created the landscapes where you work. And that in turn affects the images you pick, the techniques you pick, and we always are using more than one thing.
And it was interesting to me, like that was one of the more interesting things to read in the book, like, it's better to take this picture in the morning or in the wet season, or I should have expected that, but I didn't. And I thought that was really cool that you you have been refining your techniques, but based on what you discovered, depending on when pictures have been taken, and analyzed over the years, and then the tweaking you have to do to enhance the images. So, yeah, I like that.
Well, there was a very important lesson about science that came along with some of those stories, that it's some things that when you relate the story can sound like, well, you didn't find King Tut's tomb, but you learned how to do something. People go, ah, what a shame they didn't succeed. But the answer is, and I thank you for pointing it out, that science is rarely about the result. It's more often learning about how you get there and how to do things. And the process is what keeps us moving forward in science.
Right. Yeah, I think, I'm a big believer in complete transparency in sort of the academic research or scientific research process. And I think a bunch of scientists have gotten in trouble because, you know, they're celebrating their results and they're not being completely honest about maybe a result that got reported one way, but wasn't, you know, you didn't know the full story, data gets manipulated. And I'm like, look, we sometimes things don't go the way we hope. Sometimes there's like enormous ambiguity. Sometimes maybe you haven't done the right series of techniques, but the methodology you've created is sound. And mm-hmm. that is something that can be taken forward to be tested by other scientists in that part of the world or other parts of the world. And I think, you know, we need to be much more honest about, it's not about I found X. It's yeah. like, here's the whole process. It took years. It took a huge team of people. It didn't quite go the way we'd hoped, but you know what? It's okay. Like, mm-hmm. I'm not ashamed to admit that sometimes when I do this work and the results look like this, it's like this, or it's somewhere in the middle. So I hope when people read the book, they understand yeah. that, you know, it's not like the people who believe in aliens can point their fingers and go, ha, see, archaeologists, they're all wrong. It's like, no. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, and we love that. We love when authors explain how science is really, really done. And that I said that now because I had a question and I can't think of it.
You and I were talking about this earlier. And so in our list of compliments, one was we felt, Joanne and I were talking about this, we felt that your accounts and the stories and things were revealing and honest and authentic and mm-hmm. helps in the scientific way to understand that process is something we can learn from, whether it finds a thing or not, but that also your experiences and telling about your experiences in a full disclosure sort of manner gave us a very authentic and very valuable feeling of seeing what it's actually like and not feeling that there are things that are left out or kept secret, and that's very, very valuable.
Yeah, I really tried in the book, because oftentimes I find with when you have an author who or a scientist who maybe is telling their story, it seems like the lone hero, and mm-hmm. and that's not yes. okay by any stretch of the imagination. I really wanted to paint a full picture that I may be the PI or the co-PI of a project, but there's a huge team of people and specialists that I work with. And one person is not more important than the other. At the end of the day, I'm responsible for the budget. That is my job. I'm the hotel manager. Yes. My job is to make sure people don't get sick. It's my job to make sure people have everything they need to be really glamorous running a dig, let me tell you. But it's often my job is to empower. I don't know what phone keeps going off. Never mind. I'll just let it ring. My job is to enable really talented humans to be able to do their job to the best of their abilities. And I think that's what good leadership is. That I've learned a lot about leadership the last couple of years. I get mm-hmm. out of people's way. And I wanted to celebrate not just my colleagues, but my professional scientific colleagues, but also the workmen that I work with in places like Egypt. You know, the workman that's removing the dirt in a bucket is just as important as the PhD with 25 years experience, you know, analyzing the pottery. Like, everyone contributes in equal mm-hmm. ways on an excavation. And I wanted people to really get that understanding that that it is this team effort. And that's the other thing I tried to do throughout the book. I followed what one of my favorite science writers, Ed Yong, mm-hmm. has talked a lot about, and that's that citation accountability. So I made that a core focus of the book. So 30% of the scientists that I mention, so archaeologists and specialists throughout the book, are indigenous scientists. Mm-hmm. And there's a real intentionality to that, because it would have been really easy for me to cite primarily white Western men. And it's hard because white Western man will be the first author, and then authors 2 through 8 will be indigenous scholars or scientists. And you can only say Smith et al. Yes. Well, you know, I'm hopeful that, you know, with what Ed's done, with what, you know, authors like Angela Saini are doing, you know, I hope it can be a model for other writers of popular science books to follow, not just celebrating local workforces, but the full spectrum of all the people that are doing the work, no matter what the field is. That's really important to me. Mm-hmm.
And it comes through and it is valuable. And let's see, I'm the guy here, so I can say, and I know from enough stories how valuable it is for young girls to see people like you and Joanne and go, wow, I'd like to be like that. That's a very valuable thing that people think is such a small thing. And it is a small thing, but that doesn't mean it's not a valuable thing.
Right. I actually just to expand on that, and something we mentioned before is just how I loved how you had a chapter that was talking about the importance of diversity and inclusion and creating an environment that is welcoming to all, include women and people of color and LGBTQ, all of these, right?
With disabilities.
Disability. Yeah, that was really like, I love the part of like, well, yeah, it's really hard to get to most sites on a wheelchair, but we've worked on this in the past. So, you know, how can we do this? That was an amazing chapter. And I think every chapter that's sort of autobiographical, every book that's got some autobiographical, portion to it should include that, how important this is.
Yeah, I think, something I've been reflecting a lot on kind of in the we're still in the thick of the Me Too movement and a lot of academics, there's still more to come. I've been reflecting a lot on my experiences and my background and, of course, my privilege as a white tenured full professor at a research university. And I think it's incumbent upon those of us that have this privilege or these positions of power and authority. I mean, power, authority, what does that mean? But it means something. And I think it's my job to be very loud about all these issues and problems and challenges and obviously colonialism as well. I'm very loud about it on social media. Anytime I give a public lecture, I speak about it because it's important. I remember at National Geographic a couple summers ago, they had a panel on the future of exploration, and there were three dudes and me, and all of us were white. And I called them on it. I love National Geographic, but I think we need to hold ourselves accountable, with mantles, et cetera. Mm-hmm. But it's going to take a long time to see change. We know statistically that the majority of grad students that start in programs in anthropology and archaeology are women. It's 60-70%. And yet look at the number of tenured full professors who mm-hmm. are women, and of course people of color, indigenous, LGBT, etc. It's going to take a long time. And the good news is a lot of my senior male colleagues are going, I just didn't know. My eyes are open, and part of us are going like, what? Your eyes weren't open? But at least acknowledging that, at least they're willing to have discussions, at least they're coming to panels. So yeah, we obviously have a lot of work to do, but I'm hopeful. I'm hopeful that this book will show girls, will show women in other countries that there's a place for them, that they're welcome, that it won't be easy. But we're here to support them. We're here to encourage them and hopefully get more diversity in the field.
Right. And I'm seeing this as a trend in books, especially if it's a female author or underrepresented group author. They are more likely to mention this and to say, this path is hard and there are these problems, but I've done it. You can do it. There are people who want to help. I'm really encouraged by this trend.
Can I also say, I'm sitting here, I'm working in a disability support office right now these days. And so I hear those stories with emphasis, but the story that Joanne just mentioned of your pottery expert, but the woman who had trouble getting to the digs, and of the law right now allows, it's like, well, if there's an essential duty, then you can exclude people with disabilities. But essential is often in the eyes of the people doing the excluding. And I think that story was brilliant and symbolic. The visibility was good, but also because some people I could imagine beforehand, you say, well, she has trouble getting around and she uses a wheelchair. It's like, well, she obviously can't work on site at a dig where mobility is required. And the answer is, that's just the way you're looking at it. And you made it look like this was not a problem that couldn't be solved. This was part of welcoming someone who had something to contribute. And it's just part of getting along and welcoming people to the site. And it became a normal thing and not some special accommodation. That's brilliant.
So actually I want to talk to you about something I haven't yet really talked about in any interviews. It's very, very personal to me, and I'm going to apologize in advance if I tear up. So
it's all right.
The book dedication is actually very deeply connected to this issue. So I dedicated the book to my aunt Sue. So when she was born in the 1940s, so this is my mom's sister, some lack of oxygen at birth, so cerebral palsy, etc. And she was told, you know, you'll never, my grandparents, mm-hmm. she'll never walk, she'll never talk, but they were amazing and really pushed her. She got her GED, she's taking college courses, she had a rich career. She now lives with my mom and dad. She has her own apartment, and she was the second mom to me and my brother growing up. She lived with my grandparents. And so disability has always been something that my family is very, very passionate about. And also my mom for years worked with children and adults with disability. So I've never grown up seeing differences. I've always grown up in a very inclusive and welcoming environment. Sue is one of the warmest and most lovely humans I know. I'd rather spend time with her than most other people. And now it's lovely. Our son is like her grandson. And she turned 70 this year. So I wanted to acknowledge this human being that opened my eyes at a very young age to inclusion, to seeing what everyone has to contribute. I know she's one of the reasons why I've become an activist, and especially an activist for archaeology and trying to make things as inclusive as possible. I've seen the struggles she's faced in her life and the hurdles she's had to overcome. So yeah, it's a really deeply personal issue for me. And I really just wanted, I wanted to give it a platform because, you know, I've had students with disabilities say, I can't go on this dig. I'm like, mm-hmm. okay, that dig might not work, but let's talk about what's possible. Let's mm-hmm. talk about what might work for you given X, Y, and Z. And you just have to be willing to listen and look a little harder and talk to other dig directors to see what can be done. Why wouldn't we make that effort to be more inclusive?
That's amazing and really inspirational. I'm really glad you shared that with us, actually. I wasn't aware of that. Maybe I didn't read your dedication closely enough.
I didn't talk.
Oh, you just dedicated to her, didn't mention that. Okay. Mm-hmm. Wow, that's amazing.
But it does come through, Joanne. I mean, we saw those stories, and now we know that there was intention behind the story of one of the diggers' little girls on site spotting something unusual and stories like that to underscore the importance of diversity and inclusion of things.
Inclusion. And so I'm having trouble deciding which thing to talk about, but why don't we just segue over to your work sort of as encouraging citizen scientists and setting examples and making sure that there are opportunities for people like in India and just other countries so that young people will see these things happen. They can participate. They can, you know, start to have a passion for their history because they have an opportunity to participate in your citizen science project.
Yeah, I wore my Global Explorer t-shirt.
Oh, great.
I'm going to ask about it. So I started with a team of people at the end of in 2016, an organization called Global Explorer. So Global Explorer is an organization that's dedicated to using cutting edge technologies to empower the world to help map and protect its shared cultural heritage. And the platform we built is a citizen science crowdsourcing platform that allows anyone in the world to get online and help look at satellite images to map archaeological sites. Lest anyone think that it's a, like a looter training portal, it's not. You take the tutorial and there's no mapping information, there's no GPS information. All you know is that you're somewhere in Peru, and when we relaunch, you'll be somewhere in India. So there's no way, we get the data securely, we share it with ministries and archaeological officials, the locations are never published, we're really careful about site integrity. But yeah, it's this idea, it was a wild idea when we started, we're like, is it possible to create a citizen science or citizen archaeology movement where you can give people the tools and the training that they need? You know, it's not like they're doing advanced hyperspectral analyses on obscure imagery types. That's work for scientists. But this idea that there's a pretty significant part of what we do and what a lot of scientists do that the public can participate in. And so we created this platform as a way to engage the broadest number of people. I joke, you know, from kids from 5 to 105, the only hurdle is that you should probably know how to read, but even if you read slowly, it's fine. And access to a computer. So we wanted to build something that people could use, say, in their public libraries if they didn't have internet access at home, or on their smartphones. You know, it's something they could do while sitting on the bus on the way to work. So the big question we had is, would this actually work when people find things? And also, could archaeologists on the ground in Peru, and now as we're moving to India, could they find this data useful? So I'm very excited to share, you know, we've had about 86, 87,000 people from all over the world. I think we're missing 5 or 6 countries. I joke, we don't have North Korea. But if anyone listening knows Dennis Rodman, we can totally load up the app on an iPad for the next time he goes to see Kim Jong-un. Like, you know, everyone's welcome. It's free. And the platform's free, by the way. It's totally free for everyone. There are tons of great educator resources. So archaeologists have used this information on the ground to do ground mapping work. And my good friend, Luis Jaime Castillo, who I talk about in the book, has just been named a Minister of Culture in Peru 2 days ago. We are so excited for him. And he took the crowdsourced data from the citizen archaeologists and went out with drones to do site mapping. And he was able to get a bunch of amazing high resolution drone maps of several of the new sites. But also he used the data for his own work and was able to find 50 new Nazca lines in the Nazca region. So the idea is we never want to tell a government what to do. That's colonialists. We're trying to break colonialist models. We go to governments with a menu of things we can do. Okay, do you want site database information? Are you interested in looting? Are you interested in potential sites for tourism? Are you interested in training and so on? And we let the governments tell us what their priorities are. And we let the government play a pretty serious role in the design of the research project where we're working. They help us to identify areas of priority. We don't determine that. The governments do. The archaeologists do. So we've been really, really intentional, not just in creating this citizen science movement, but this whole concept of how do you decolonize archaeology? How do you bring in different perspectives? Because ultimately, what am I going to do with a database of 20,000 archaeological sites? I'm going to analyze it and write articles about it that 6 people read. I mean, that's important, but like, it's ridiculous. You know, that data needs to be in the hands of governments. So yeah. I welcome everyone to use it. It's globalexplorer.org. And you know, we're going to India next, which Joanne referred to, which we're so excited about. We're rebuilding the platform right now. We'll be relaunching end of this year, beginning of next year. And obviously India is a big place. It'll take us a bit of time to
get
that data.
This is really cool. And I just tweeted that we were talking about Global Explorer. So hopefully people will go there and check that out. Because I love citizen science. Of course, I'm a cell biologist. So I have always loved FoldIt, where, you know, people are trying to, you know, play a game folding proteins because we're better. Mm-hmm. Our eyes are better at this than a computer at this point. Right. Yep. So, well, and yeah, go ahead.
There's just a... That was the thing that amazed me earlier when I was reading it, is because there is so much of the Earth to look at that it makes sense to have teams of hundreds or thousands of people who are doing the looking and agreeing and saying, oh, look, it does look like there's something interesting here. And that helps you get to all of these things in a way that you couldn't do practically if you left it to scientists to do. So it's a big data version of doing science that is a very exciting project.
And what we're doing, because one of the, you know, this is science, we iterate, we look and we reflect on what worked and what didn't work. So when the project, even though you can still go online and still look at images, you know, after the first year and a half, we reached out to a number of our citizen archaeologists and went, hey, we're going to India next. You know, what would we get right? What did we get wrong? And we solicited a great deal of feedback on how we could improve the platform. And one of the complaints, and I don't want to say it was a mean complaint, it was just like a general comment, was, gosh, sometimes I look at 100 images and I don't find anything. Well, welcome to my world. we guarantee that you will find 10 sites today. sometimes people do, and that's awesome. Yeah. So we wanted to improve the user experience and also try to think, like, how could we make this go faster? Because so many of the tiles, when you get on, it's like flat desert, cloudy, blurry, trees. Mm-hmm. And so we're collaborating with a team of people at an organization I can't mention yet. It hasn't been announced. But we're incorporating machine learning into the back end. Mm-hmm. And what the machine is going to do, so we've identified hundreds of landscape types where you typically, you know, dense tree cover, you can't see through trees with optical satellite data, so those don't need to be in the platform. Densely urbanized areas with no exposed dirt, those don't have sites. So all those tiles will be eliminated, and then we're going to input hundreds and hundreds of examples of known archaeological sites. Ah. So what the machine will do is it will prioritize the tiles that have a high degree of likelihood of having a thing, and the crowd will then vote on them. And then once we say, yes, it is a thing, that data will then go back into the machine to, again, reprioritize. So again, we're not guaranteeing that the users are going to find a thing in every tile, but it certainly won't be one in every 100. Maybe it's one in every 5. Maybe one it's in every 10. And that way, the process will go much, much faster.
Ah, very cool. There, someone just sent a question, or I should say sent a question. I didn't see it right away. We were talking about disabilities. And of course, he asked, does remote sensing from space or drones offer more equal opportunities for people with disabilities? And I guess maybe we've already been answering this.
Actually, I've got a great story to share on how it does. So a friend of mine is Israeli, and he told me the story, and I had no idea this story even existed. So in Israel, everyone has to do national service with the military.
Right.
But because it's, you know, very intense training and a lot of noise, a lot of interaction, people with autism spectrum disorder, not everyone can participate. I'm not saying people with ASD haven't participated, but in general, it's, you know,
more of a challenge.
Yeah. It can be more of a challenge. So there was a pretty good, sizable group of people in Israel that felt like, you know, they wanted to contribute to their country and they couldn't. And so some really smart person realized, wait a minute, people with ASD, not all, but in general, can be hyper-focused on tasks that require great attention to detail in ways that people who are non-SD can't do necessarily. And so they created a division, an image processing division in the Army specifically for people with ASD to serve in. And they're apparently, like, amazing. They're one of the best divisions in the world. So to me, this is wonderful. You wanna meet people where they are, right. And also, you know, make them feel like, you know, not just like in a fake way, but in a genuine way. Hey, we're using your abilities to the best of our ability. So that's just one example of where a country has worked really hard to it's not an accommodation. It's figuring out what the exceptional abilities are.
Yeah, working with their strengths. I have a daughter on the spectrum, and actually, one thing I always found amazing was she was an excellent soccer goalie. Because all she really had to watch was the ball. Where is the ball? And that's it. And stop the ball from coming in. And she's less concerned about the people playing with the ball. She just needed to focus on the ball. So she got MVP often because that's it. She could focus on that. So it's the same thing. It's like you find what someone's natural strengths are, and you are able to capitalize on that for many purposes. So, wow, you know, I just talking to you, I love the book, but now talking to you, I love what you do even more. And just how opening and welcoming you are for all of this, and to make this an exciting field for people across the world, like not just people sitting in academia.
Thank you. Well, I hope, you know, it's been interesting too, since Global Explorers launched, I'm beginning to have dialogues with colleagues who are sitting on very large satellite or remotely sensed data sets, in some cases LIDAR imagery, and the idea that over time, and we can't do it immediately because platforms take a while to evolve and it's expensive, but the idea that we can have it as a repository for processed imagery over large parts of the earth, and basically use it as a way for people to get involved and share information, because it takes some of my colleagues, you know, months and months and months, if not years, to look at all this information. And the idea that they can get that data much faster. But then it's like, you don't just want to use people's time. And I know this is a big debate in citizen science, you know, the idea like, oh, well, you're using people, you're not paying them. And I respect that a lot. So that's why, first of all, when we created the platform, we wanted to make it a game. We wanted to make it fun. And also, I mean, it's not like we're forcing people to use the platform. It's like, if you're interested in archaeology, here's this opportunity to participate. You're welcome to. If you don't want to, you don't have to. But we're giving our users a lot. So there's tons of information. You know, we do regular, whether it's a Google Hangout, whether it's chats. The idea that eventually, as the citizen scientists find sites, that information goes to colleagues in the field. And the idea that our colleagues can, without revealing the location of the sites, you know, do a Periscope, or live tweeting from the field, or blogging like, hey, here I am. Oh my gosh, there's a site. Look at this pottery. I can't believe you guys found this. This is so exciting. This is a significant. So in that way, you're repaying with content that, frankly, like, who gets to see a live Periscope from a new archaeological site? Like, and it's a new way of thinking about archaeology. You know, we see some archaeologists, I think of, you know, Lee Berger, his work with Homo Naledi and Rising Star, and the idea that he does, you know, live blogging and has cameras down with the caves, with the anthropologists and the cave specialists. So this idea that we can bring cutting edge science as it's happening to people's living rooms goes a long way to addressing this issue of like, well, what are people getting out of it? It's like, right, they're participating, but they're giving, and they're getting to.
And it helps make science something that's relevant and can be a part of people's lives who thought they didn't have any room for science or didn't need it or weren't capable, perhaps. Right. And that's a good thing. I kind of hate to talk about looting, because it's such an upsetting thing, and the whole antiquities illicit trade and things like that. But maybe we can talk positive for a bit about about what you found about how remote sensing techniques that you've been using to locate sites and things can contribute to helping people stop this, control this, detect where looting is going on, and do something about it that's been productive.
Yeah, so the, you know, a number of colleagues, as well as myself, have been looking at high-resolution satellite imagery, sort of mapping looting in Syria, Afghanistan, Iraq, Egypt, Libya, American Southwest. There's a cohort of us that's working on this. And so, yeah, I guess I'll talk kind of big picture, because this actually has a lot to do with decolonizing messages around the Middle East. So the story in the Middle East and in Egypt and Syria was, oh, well, you know, the Arab Spring happened, things were destabilized, and the looting got worse. Ergo, this is what happens when people protest, they can't control their own countries. Mm. That's like, no. it's not a okay message. There's looting that goes on everywhere all the time across the US and in every country in the world. So what we were able to do, we had 13 years of high-resolution satellite imagery. We had a huge database of sites across Egypt. So we looked at satellite imagery every year at every site in Egypt. So from 2002 to 2013, 2014. And we found looting at hundreds of sites. We mapped over 200,000 looting pits. And what we were able to do is track the number and size of looting pits over time. So you could kind of see his chart. And what's interesting is the looting stayed kind of consistent between 2002 and 2008 and 2009. You know, little spikes here and there, but pretty low. But in 2009 to 2010, we see the S start going up and you're like, wait a minute, that's before the Arab Spring. Mm-hmm. So we cross-referenced the looting numbers against youth unemployment, GDP, inflation, and tourism numbers. And as it turns out, it's the economy, stupid. the looting was connected to the global recession that happened in 2009 into 2010. So the reason the looting got worse after the Arab Spring was because it was already going that way.
Yeah.
Right. So the question is, to what extent was this going on in Syria and Iraq? And I think it was the same story. You know, archaeological sites are in some cases like piggy banks. And when you can no longer afford meat for your family or your kids' school fees, it's like a gig economy, right? It's not like you're, you know, the desperate looters. It's not a black and white issue. It's, oh, it's a little extra money that I can earn for my family to kind of keep them afloat. These are not people that are buying Porsches. These are people that are, you know, getting an operation or trying to get school fees. And we'd do the same thing to support our families if we lived in these places. It's complex, really difficult. So
very difficult.
But it's just about deconstructing these very white Western narratives using the data. And it's like, okay, then could potentially looting data predict instability in a country? When the looting gets to a certain point, we see that that country is under threat. Is it a non-political way of analyzing things? And I think it is. I think that could be a really interesting approach. But no one at the State Department has called me yet. Shocking.
Wow. No one's surprised. So, oh gosh, we are close to the end. You know, I'm a little AWOL trying to figure out the technical issues. So thanks for people who finally found, because I had to post new links. Anyway, what I wanted to say was actually one of my favorite chapters was your future chapter, where you made up a story of what the future of archaeology could look like with drones and, you know, tiny drones released. And yeah, impressive idea there, like science fiction, as you said, you sort of have a fascination with it. So I wouldn't be surprised if this is how it plays out.
So, you know, growing up with Asimov and Bradbury and so many others and Neal Stephenson, and now getting to read extraordinary authors like N.K. Jemisin, you know, this idea of creating futures where, you know, I tell the story of this guy named Robbie. I don't want to ruin the story for people, but basically he's, you know, he's using drones. He's using all these tools and a little kit he carries around, and he's got an hour to map a whole site, and he comes up with a site history. And then I step back and I know y'all think that I've lost my mind, but let me walk you through all the technologies that I've talked about and exactly where we are and where things are going. And I think given the pace of advancement in technology, I genuinely think we'll get there faster than 100 years. So the story takes place in 2119. I loved writing that chapter. It was the biggest chapter.
I could tell. It just sparkled. It sparkled. Oh. I liked it. So maybe you have a future in sci-fi writing too.
Don't tempt me.
When all the archaeological sites have been discovered, then you will have time for that.
That's right. I'll add it to the list. But yeah, I would love to write sci-fi. That would be amazing. And I will say, like, I don't know how people write full-time. I have so much respect. And I look at the book. It's so surreal seeing your book, baby. I told one interviewer, I said, I feel like I went to spacearchaeologybooks.com and just like clicked and I got the book. And my husband's like, no, actually, there were 6 months of last year that I don't want to talk about. I'm like, oh yeah, the 6 months I don't remember. I wrote this book.
Yeah, we get a good mix of people who go, yep, I'll be writing another book. It was great. And then other people go, I think that's it for a while.
Yeah, I think I need to at least kind of let this one, I mean, it's just come out 2 days ago.
I have a lot of art right now, right?
Written. So I need to get back to those before I dive in again.
Well, I think people can see. So yeah, I'm feeling like we're summarizing kind of, but how many wonderful and useful and valuable in so many ways stories there are. And when we were talking about science and visibility for people and diversity and things, the thing we're particularly interested here at Read Science is the same visibility for science. And the stories that you write all have that idea that we value of not avoiding something, a topic like science, when it comes up naturally in the discussion. And it also felt like you didn't avoid these other issues that had to do with looting, but also with science, but also with people with disabilities, but also with science, but also with women doing archaeology, but also with science and also with history and things. And it was a lovely thing, a feeling of interesting stories that weren't trying to avoid so many topics.
Yeah, I think, you know, anytime you're trying to paint this full picture, because ultimately, you know, why does the past matter? Why should we care about archaeology in this age of, you know, climate change and political challenges and migration? And the idea that by creating empathy for the stories and the people who lived in the past, it can give us more perspective. It can give us, not like a Pollyannish, like everything's going to be fine, because it isn't. But this idea of this long arc of humanity, and understanding our trajectory and understanding what's worked and what hasn't, that's really what I wanted to lay out in the book. And it's hard because, like, clearly I'm very, very passionate about these issues, and I feel very strongly about them, and I'm probably a lot more passionate isn't the right word, but strident isn't a good word either, but I pushy in a good way on social media, that I don't want to say I couldn't be in the book, I could have gone in that way, but like gentle, showing why disability is a really essential issue, why decolonizing archaeology, why promoting issues of gender parity and etc., like how it fits in, how it weaves in, how it connects to these stories that had to be done in a very intentional, careful way. So, because I said at one point, like, it's you're seducing a reader when they're turning the pages, and you want to keep getting them turning. If every reader goes, like, that's it, you've lost. So how do you keep this through line of your message of the past is important, the past is for everyone, the past is essential for us today and pushing us towards wherever we're going. But have that balanced with good stories and humor. So yeah, I had to learn how to do all that. It was not easy.
Well, you succeeded wonderfully. And really, what I guess I never gave thought until I started hearing about you of how we could use satellite for archaeology. You know, I'm used to technology for sequencing the genome and pushing things forward, but I hadn't given this much thought. Although I shouldn't say that, because my son works with remote sensing, but he's climate work. Anyway, so don't worry. If I start talking about my kids, we'll be here all day. So I think it's about time to say goodbye to our guests, unless you have one more or two more things to add, Sarah.
So I would, you know, if I hope you all enjoy the book, and I would challenge anyone who reads it to take some action. There are action items, whether you participate in Global Explore, whether you get involved in your local museum, but challenge yourself, you know, to get some different perspectives too. I'm only one voice amongst many, many thousands. So go hear a lecture at your local museum or university, or go participate in a volunteer day, get involved in some way. You know, try to see how other people are telling these stories too, because so many people have so many different ways of sharing stories about the past. So if you read the book, that's, I'm a professor, I get to assign homework. Your homework is do one small thing to kind of see how archaeology works outside of how I've talked about it.
Well, thank you, Sarah. I really appreciate your passion. I'm glad you wrote your book. I am glad I read it. Everybody, if you can get a copy of Archaeology from Space by Sarah Parkak, you'll be glad you did. Even if you hardly know anything about archaeology, I learned a lot more. I'm used to peering under a microscope, so maybe I needed a bigger picture. So, and Jeff, thank you very much. Everybody, thank you for bearing with the technical issues. If you're watching this recorded, well, that didn't affect you at all. So. wonder why is she apologizing. Okay, until next time on Read Science, thank you.
Thank you.